Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we talk about the end of the world, or rather, why we like to talk about the end of the world. Apocalyptic end-of-the-world scenarios are not new. Accounts of them go back at least a millennium in Western cultures and even further in non-Western ones. But you don't have to look far today to see more than a few. Climate change, peak oil, the Mayan calendar are three common scenarios today. And go back just a few years. Remember the Y2K computer bug? For others, the Great Recession was a signal. Don't forget Harold Camping's predictions. My guest today says this is to be expected in times of dramatic societal stress and social change and follows a common pattern through history. My guest today is Matthew Gross. He was the Internet Communications Director for the Howard Dean campaign back in 2003 and 4. Today he is a campaign and NGO consultant. He co-authored a book with Mel Gillis, The Last Myth, What the Rise of Apocalyptic Thinking Tells Us About America. It's published by Prometheus Books. In it, he recounts a long history of apocalyptic beliefs over time, and he joins us to tell us what makes humans prone to end-of-time stories. Matthew Gross, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We've been through a succession of events that have given way to this general feeling of unease about the future. In your book, The Last Myth, sort of outlines these events, the Y2K, which most of us have forgotten about. Of course, 9/11. You know, climate change is a part of our present and future. Hurricane Katrina, where we saw government really break down. Peak oil, the Great Recession, and our political system, you know, being just at loggerheads where if your side is out of power, you really feel like the other side that is in power is basically driving our country to hell in a handbasket, if you will, you know. And of course, you have events like Harold Camping and the Mayan calendar. All of these events seem to either create or reflect a feeling of apocalyptic thinking. What do you think is at the heart of fueling all of this?
I think at the heart of sort of the apocalyptic storyline and why we see this rise of apocalyptic thinking, not only in the real world events, but in pop culture these days, is there's a fundamental disconnect between what people see happening and what our culture tells us will happen or should be happening, right? We grew up, most of us, believing in the institutions of government and believing that our democracy was functional and that if we came together, we could address many of the problems before us. And I think what we're seeing is many of the problems before us, we don't understand how we might grapple with them, where they seem so large and unprecedented that we feel powerless. So, and in that powerlessness, I think we turn to the apocalyptic storyline, to the idea that it will all come to an end because we can't quite imagine the way forward.
You know, there's certainly been lots of events in which it seemed like there was no way out. The Great Depression, you know, it lasted for nearly a decade. But did you see the rise of apocalyptic thinking then? You know, at the worst ebb of World War II, it looked like democracy was going down to fascism. But was there apocalyptic thinking then? It seemed like there was more of a, well, we just have to figure out what to do next sort of attitude.
I think that's correct, and I think that's what makes this particular moment and apocalyptic thinking these days a bit unique. And I think there's several things going on. One is, if you look back to the 1970s, we did kind of see a rise in apocalyptic thinking, and Hal Lindsey's The Late Great Planet Earth became the bestseller of the decade, actually, which looked at what was going on in the Middle East to find signs of divination. And I think one thing that we have happening is a lot of the teens and 20-somethings in the 70s who were reading Hal Lindsey are now producing content. They're now writing. They're now in political power. And that worldview has sort of been carried forward. But I also think what's going on is, you know, a fundamental, again, a disconnect between a belief that we've had for the last 30 years that globalization and progress would lead us all to a better future. That belief is turning out to be untrue. And so we're searching around for a way out. And I do think, yes, in World War II, at the end of World War II, we had very dire times and dark times. But there is a fundamental belief that America would pull through. And I think we've lost that belief, and thus we turn to apocalyptic thinking as a way out.
One of the things you wrote in the book was that man has always been prone to apocalyptic thinking, but it's always at a time of great social change and unease about the present. I mean, if things get better, will this all subside? because it seems like it's been one event after another from, you know, the sort of millennial. And this is the other thing, is that man has been prone at certain sort of turning points, whether it's the turn of the century or the turn of the millennium. I think the year 1000, there was lots of thought in the Dark Ages that this was going to be the end. Well, you know, with the year 1000, that'll be it. There'll be a new renewal.
Right. Well, certainly apocalyptic thinking has been a recurring phenomenon throughout all of Western history, really, for the last 2,500 years. But I think what we find, as you point out, is it does surge into the mainstream, which is, I think, what it's doing now. And, you know, it will certainly, if things get better, I think we might see it subside. But I think a great analogy is during the Reformation. You know, this was a period of tremendous political turmoil when many people believed that the Catholic Church, which of course was the ruling institution of Europe, was irredeemably corrupt and incapable of ruling the man-made world. And so there was a surge in apocalyptic thinking. No one could imagine a way out. But of course what happened was Martin Luther nailed his 95 Theses to the door of All Saints Church, and the Reformation happened, and soon thereafter the Enlightenment happened, and a new way of looking at the world kind of emerged from this moment. But if you went back to that pre-Reformation, during the Reformation period, everybody believed virtually that the world was going to end, and of course it didn't. Instead, a new way of looking at the world emerged. And I think we may be at a moment like that now.
Well, you sort of document sort of our reaction to a variety of these events over the last 12 years, and of course really where you began to hear about this apocalyptic thinking was as the millennium approached, and you had this other problem, which is that our computers, which had so increasingly taken over a lot of functions of our society, was not going to be able to cope with the year 2000, and of course the Y2K bug. And you said that we took the wrong lesson from Y2K when it turned out, as most people figured, that it was not that big a deal. In fact, in some places it would somewhat of a big deal. It wouldn't be airplanes falling out of the air, but it would be a costly change for business.
Yes, I think we did take the wrong lesson, because I think many of us look back on Y2K and we tend to package it as some sort of hoax, because none of the worst case scenarios happened where airplanes didn't come flying out of the sky or dams didn't suddenly open up their floodgates and send
the
down
grid didn't turn off. The grid didn't turn off. Yeah, right.
Exactly. Things kept going. But things kept going because we did take action to avert the crisis. We did spend lots of money, billions of dollars, to improve our electronic infrastructure. And if you look forward even, that improvement, I think, paid dividends and helped pave the way for the rise of the Internet throughout the last 12 years. I mean, certainly the Internet, of course, was around in the late 90s. But that investment in infrastructure really paid dividends that we couldn't foresee at the time. But instead, we look back at Y2K and we think, oh, it was all a hoax. And I think what that does is it creates a tendency for many of us to think of anything that is portrayed in apocalyptic terms, which, unfortunately, many issues are now portrayed in apocalyptic terms, from climate change to peak oil. We tend to dismiss it because we have this experience of, well, it didn't happen before, so it probably won't happen again. And so every issue kind of gets bundled together.
It's interesting because some will dismiss it, others will take it absolutely to heart. I think that's the kind of weird thing about apocalyptic thinking. If the conspiratorial outside of the envelope of the issue matches sort of your general worldview, you tend to accept it, you know, even though after we see how these sort of problems can be overhyped.
I think that's exactly right. And one of the things about apocalyptic thinking is it really is a reflection of a person's worldview. So if you believe that we need to have a better relationship with nature, you're certainly going to embrace these apocalyptic ideas of global warming, because the apocalyptic threat of global warming proves your worldview correct, that we need to rein in industrial civilization or behave in a more sustainable way. So, of course, that apocalyptic scenario validates what you already believe.
My guest today is Matthew Gross. He was the Internet Communications Director for the Howard Dean campaign back in 2003 and 2004. He's a consultant to campaigns and non-governmental organizations today. He's co-author with Mel Gillis of The Last Myth, What the Rise of Apocalyptic Thinking Tells Us About America. It's published by Prometheus Books. Now, you go back in time and sort of look at the whole history of, well, first of all, the word apocalyptic and the apocalypse. There's something interesting about the actual origin of this word.
Yes, it actually comes to us from the Greek, and it means the lifting of the veil. And when we think about the history of the apocalypse in the Judeo-Christian tradition, what people are really looking for in apocalyptic thinking is a revelation of the meaning of history. And I think that's something that still plays out, and I think that's why we still go to the apocalyptic storyline. Even if we aren't ourselves particularly religious, if we're secular people, that is still appealing. It's still very appealing to believe that there will be a moment when everybody will understand universally the way the world is.
You know, it's really interesting when you talk to biblical scholars, when they talk about like the Revelation or the book of Daniel, which is also an apocalypse. Mm-hmm. In both of those cases, we now read Daniel as history of, you know, the Jews being led off to Babylonia. Daniel, as a lot of biblical scholars will say, was written about Rome. You couldn't write about Rome, so you wrote about Babylonia. The same with Revelations. Is there a feeling that these were actually putting the veil down in these apocalyptic books in the Bible?
Well, that's exactly right. Yeah, and there's, you know, particularly in Revelations and the book of Daniel, there's a conceit of the books having been written hundreds of years earlier, decades earlier, so that the authors can then comment upon what's happening in their current time in a political way. And they're very political books. You know, apocalyptic thinking has never really been very much separated from what's happening in the real world. You know, much of the apocalyptic anticipation that you found around the time of Christ arose from Israel being sort of buffeted by these greater empires and tides of empires coming to and fro, and there was this desire to escape history.
Yeah, and it gets into another, we want to talk about the idea of myth versus history, which is a big theme in the book, but first of all, let's go back to ancient man. Was ancient man prone to talk about the end of the world?
No, they weren't, and that's one of the things that, as we wrote the book, we found fascinating. You know, we tend to think, oh, everybody has always believed in the end of the world. But when you actually go back and look at history and what ancient people believed and prehistoric people believed, they really didn't have this expectation of the end of the world. They may have had myths that thought about the end of the world, but it wasn't something that people ordered their lives around as many Christians do today, and one could argue many of the 3 million people who call themselves preppers do today in the United States. Instead, traditional people were really concerned with how did the world come to be. And there was a sense, obviously, of cyclical time and a repetition of ancient archetypes. And people found meaning from understanding creation. And so the end of the world was kind of an afterthought. And it's only with the development of a linear view of time and the idea that history matters that we begin to see this expectation of the end of the world.
So with myth comes this sort of static view of the world, that it was always here, it is here, and it will always be here.
Well, and you did have, you know, views of cycles of destruction and renewal, views which most likely arose from observing the seasons and the life cycles of plants and animals and fellow human beings. So it wasn't completely static, but it was stable. The world was as it was meant to be. Whereas when you think apocalyptically, there's usually the expectation that the world isn't as it should be, and something needs to happen to make it as it should be.
And, you know, with monotheism, you know, I think Greeks had this idea of this sort of static world.
Yeah.
Myth, and all of a sudden, here comes monotheism from the Middle East, and it has a creation story.
It has a creation story, and in the history of the Israelites, you see a story start to emerge where, again, they're kind of a minor people. They're buffeted by empires, and they go through all these trials and tribulations in history. And they start to imagine, instead of the Lord just delivering them a promised land, delivering them an escape from history. And from that desire to escape history and to escape the political turmoil going around them, that's where we really start to see the rise of apocalyptic expectation. And it's into that sort of cauldron of apocalyptic expectation that Jesus of Nazareth arrives to make his ministry.
Yeah, and from there, you all of a sudden start reading history, and then history actually sort of leads this linear thought of civilizations rise, they flourish, they decline, and that adds to this worldview as well.
It absolutely does. You know, I mean, you know, it's quite interesting. You know, around the time of ancient Israel in Mesopotamia, you know, people were conquered and subjugated by other empires, and it really wasn't uncommon for people to sort of interpret that as something happening in the mythical realm of the gods, right? And most people in Mesopotamia at the time believed that, you know, their god was kind of centered in place, and what happened in the real world was a reflection of what was happening in the mythical realm. So if the Babylonians came and conquered you, then their god Marduk must have been more powerful than your god, and you'd probably abandon your god and begin to worship Marduk. But what the Hebrews did was quite phenomenal. They instead began to interpret not their defeat as something that happened in the mythical realm. Instead, they began to interpret history as the place where God's plans were unfolding. And so they began to interpret that, you know, the people conquering them and the leaders who were conquering them, even though they didn't believe in their God, those people were being controlled by their God. And so there was an ultimate plan that would at some point be revealed.
And defeat was not in your God was more powerful than my God, is that we must have upset God so that he did not give us victory. Or, you know, this is why this decline happened. He is upset with us, as opposed to, you know, your God is more powerful than my God.
That's exactly right. And when the Jewish people were exiled in Babylon, you really see a strengthening of the monotheistic belief among the Jewish people and the people who remained Jewish because of that. And in fact, what you see is a lot of interpretation of their defeat at the hands of the Babylonians being God being angry with them for sort of tolerating polytheistic strains within the Judaic tradition. And, you know, those strains are well known. They're the reason that, you know, when Moses chastises the Hebrews for worshiping the golden calf, that's a story of these kind of ongoing polytheistic strains that are, you know, very, very long and enduring in the ancient Jewish history.
My guest today is Matthew Gross. He is co-author with Mel Gillis of The Last Myth, What the Rise of Apocalyptic Thinking Tells Us About Americans. Well, you go through the ancient world, and then you go through, you know, we talked a little bit about the Reformation and how there was a rise of apocalyptic thinking then. The United States has been very prone to apocalyptic thinking. And the only thing I can think of is that this country has moved so quickly in such a short amount of time. We look at China today and we talk about how, you know, it has moved in a lot in a short amount of time. But the United States, compared to other nations, has moved quite a long way in a short amount of time that has that feeling of transitory change, and we as humans are usually uneasy with change. So we've been, I think, perhaps more prone to this. Would you agree?
I think I think one of the reasons we are prone to it is when you think about our heritage and the pilgrims leaving Southampton, the Puritans leaving Southampton, you know, they left because they rejected this compromise between the Anglican compromise between the Reformation churches and the Protestant churches and Catholicism. And they really came, and even before they arrived on the shores of America, we have that story of John Winthrop on the decks of the Arbella talking about the shining city on the hill. And what he's really talking about is America is going to be a place that is going to be an example of millennial perfection for the world, and it's going to be the new Israel. And I think that history, you know, going back to our very beginnings of believing that America had a manifest destiny, that we had a special place in the world, and that special place was very closely tied to building a millennial perfection on earth to usher in the return of Christ.
But you also saw many times, I'm thinking in the 1840s and 1850s, when all of a sudden you had this new wave of immigration, people were dislocated in their jobs, there were financial panics.
Yes.
All of a sudden you started seeing apocalyptic theories there that, you know, this was not the America I knew, and this America is changing. And out of it comes, again, apocalyptic thinking. And you detail some really interesting sort of end-of-the-world scenarios. Can you share a couple with us?
Well, yes. You know, I think the 1840s was an incredible time of sort of premillennial experimentation, where you see the rise of the Shakers and the Oneida community. You see the rise of Mormonism. And what you've really seen is a reaction, as you say, to rapid change and the beginning of industrialization in America. And what arises from this experience over 30 or 40 years is really the beginning of what we would call today kind of evangelical fundamentalism, which is a true rejection of these ideas of progress, right? There's a reason that there's these recurring themes of religion versus science and creationism versus evolution. What you're really seeing are two different worldviews at play there. And those two worldviews, I think, have been intertwined in American history since our inception, but certainly has accelerated through the 19th and 20th centuries. And those are kind of a belief in a religious worldview with an apocalyptic end, and a progressive worldview in which if we work together, we will create a better world on Earth.
Do you think that is a fundamental disconnect in our society today that keeps us, you know, we look at Congress and how progressives and conservatives can't seem to get together, even find a middle ground on a lot of issues. Do you think it's that disconnect that's at its heart, maybe?
I think there is that disconnect, but I also think, you know, one of the things that we've lost in that we get lost when we start to think apocalyptically and think that it's all going to end is we really start to become entrenched in an us versus them attitude, right? And what we need to do, I believe, is return to the notion that if we can understand why we're thinking apocalyptically, and not just religious people, but secular people as well, and what that means and what the effects are, I think then we might be able to return to a hope in the future, which you really need a hope in the future to reach legislative compromise. If you think it's all going to end and a final showdown is imminent, you're going to dig in, and if you're a Democrat, you're going to fight the Republicans, and if you're a Republican, you're going to fight the Democrats, because it's all going to end very soon. But if you believe that it's not going to end, in fact, the world's going to continue, you know, that's a level of maturity that I think we need at the political level that makes you think, well, I'm going to live with these people for a long time. I need to come to some sort of compromise and some sort of solution. And I think that's one of the dangers that we see on the political scale of this apocalyptic rhetoric is sort of intractable and incessant fighting when what most people really want is governance.
And in your last chapter, you sort of get at the economic heart of that sort of divide as well between those who believe that growth is inevitable, growth will always continue, and then, say, maybe the more environmental side that looks at more and more people on Earth living as Americans, which is sort of the ideal around the world. And that level of energy consumption, that level of just overall consumption, and it being unsustainable. And that group looking at, okay, how do we manage our lives better in a society based on decline, not necessarily decline of the society, but decline of the use of resources, decline in population as we go over the top on the population curve, which is expected to happen sometime this century.
Yeah.
And that's a big fundamental disconnect as well.
It is a fundamental disconnect, you know, and we tend to think all of us have grown up in a world where we believe continued growth and increasing prosperity is our birthright. And I think what we're seeing now, and we've seen that particularly in the last 30 years with globalization and the promise that if we raise the standard of living around the world, everything would be better. And instead, what we're kind of recognizing is as the standard of living in places like China and India rise, and as their energy consumption rises, we as Americans are actually less in the driver's seat, particularly when you think about energy prices. We can decrease our use of fossil fuels. We can increase our energy efficiency. But what we find is, you know, that those savings on our side of the ledger simply are met by increasing demand on the other side of the ledger.
I remember one friend of mine saying, you know, it's a scale. You know, when you raise one side, the other side has to come down a little bit. And hopefully you meet in the middle, you know.
Well, that's exactly right. And you know, I think that's creating a lot of apocalyptic anxiety in America, where we don't understand where things are going to go. I mean, we see our wages declining or remaining flat for the majority of people. We see the price of fuel going up. And, you know, there's a fundamental disconnect between what we see and what we were led to believe would happen. And so we have this return to this apocalyptic storyline that it's all going to collapse at some point. But the reality is it probably won't collapse, right? It will just continue. And I think the challenge that we have as individuals and as a society is to come up with stories and a narrative that allows us to maybe shift our priorities, to understand that, well, that was a moment in history when getting the larger car and the larger house, to gargantuan sizes, as we saw in the 90s, was just a moment in history, and that really wasn't the meaning of our lives and the most important thing for us to strive for.
So what's been the reaction of this book so far, Matthew?
We've been quite amazed by it. From quite a few people who are deeply religious, they've simply loved the religious history. And because I think it, in a very concise way, explains how we got here in the history of apocalyptic thinking. And for example, a friend of mine, we live in Utah, and her Mormon father was like, I was fascinated by the history, and I'm going to bring it to my Mormon Bible study group. And for many other people, I think they've found that it's articulated, some anxieties they feel, but it's also the best reaction that we've gotten and the most exciting reaction has been people who have read the book and have realized that maybe without even knowing so that they had been thinking apocalyptically and that they were worried about a panoply of things, from epidemics to global warming to energy depletion to, even the more absurd scenarios of a meteor striking the Earth. And I think what people have realized is that anxiety, that apocalyptic storyline, really takes up a lot of energy and produces a lot of discomfort and unhappiness in people's lives. And the best reaction we've gotten, and we've gotten it from multiple people, is this book has really allowed me to let go of my anxieties and refocus and begin to reimagine how I want to live my life.
The name of the book is The Last Myth, What the Rise of Apocalyptic Thinking Tells Us About America. It's a really interesting book, looking at all of this sort of apocalyptic thinking, how it's arisen through our history and looking back to ancient man as well as more modern man. And it's a really interesting book. Matthew Gross, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Matthew Gross is co-author with Mel Gillis of The Last Myth, What the Rise of Apocalyptic Thinking Tells Us About America. It's published by Prometheus Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent shows, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for Studio Tulsa on the front page, and that will give you links to old shows. Also, we're back up on iTunes as well, so you can find the show there as well. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.